We've got a couple more to go. This is number seven, I think. And today we're going to talk about greatness in the kingdom of heaven. So I'm going to give you a little who am I. Some of you know this right away, and some of you won't, if you're younger probably. Who am I? I've wrestled with alligators. I've tussled with a whale. I've done handcuff lightning and thrown thunder in jail. You know I'm bad. Just last week I murdered a rock, injured a stone, hospitalized a brick. I'm so mean, I make medicine sick. If you don't know yet, this next line you'll know. I'm not the greatest, I'm the double greatest. Not only do I knock them out, I pick the round. I'm the boldest, the prettiest, the most superior, most scientific, most skillfulest fighter in the ring today. Yeah. How did Cassius Clay, a.k.a. Muhammad Ali, become the greatest of all time, or at least during his lifetime, right? He beat down the competition, didn't he? Over and over and over again. How about the GOAT, the greatest of all time in basketball? Now, if you're younger, you might think that LeBron James is the greatest player. But if you're a little older, my generation, you have to say, it has to be Michael Jordan, hands down. I mean, six NBA finals, and he won every single one of them. But how did these people get to the top of their game? They beat people down, right? They overcame over and over and over again. They outperformed, they outshot, they outscored. They won again and again and again. And the same is true. Military leaders, political leaders, the super wealthy, one common thread is that they've always won over and over and over. They rose above the competition, they worked hard, and they worked, and they worked, and they worked, and quite often, not always, they had to push other people out of the way to get to where they're going. In order to become the greatest in the world, one needs to surpass other people. Gaining positions of authority, you want to get it and hang on for the ride, because usually it's only for a limited time. But the crazy thing is, right, in God's economy, the more powerful, the more influential are not the ones that are at the top, are they? In God's economy, the one who serves everyone else is at the top, is what he says. So Rick Warren, in his book, early on in the book, The Purpose-Driven Life, written quite a while ago, he says something that's very foundational to service. He says this, it's not about you. The purpose of your life is far greater than your own personal fulfillment, your peace of mind, or even your happiness. It is far greater than your family, your career, or even your wildest dreams and ambitions. If you want to know why you are placed on this planet, you must begin with God. You were born by His purpose and for His purpose. Isn't that true? So my life, ironically, is not about or actually for me, Jesus says. It is to be spent for God's purpose. And one of the values is to serve other people for their good. So we will never live lives of service if we don't first come to grips with the fact that life is not about me. It's about God, and it's about loving and serving other people. So our main thing today in your notes, greatness in God's kingdom is measured by our service to others. It's measured by our service to others. We're going to look at a few different Bible stories here, and here's the first one. Matthew 20, starting in verse 20. Then the mother of Zebedee's sons came to Jesus with her sons and, kneeling down, asked a favor of him. What is it you want? He asked. She said, grant that one of these two sons of mine sit at your right and the other at your left in your kingdom. You don't know what you're asking, Jesus said to them. Can you drink the cup I'm going to drink? We can, they answered. Jesus said to them, you will indeed drink from my cup, but to sit at my right or left is not for me to grant. These places belong to those for whom they've been prepared by my Father. When the ten heard about this, they were indignant with the two brothers. Jesus called them together and said, you know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be your slave, just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. Could Jesus be more clear on what leads to positions of authority or of greatness? I don't think he could he? It's as clear as day. He says the normal practice in society is to flaunt one's authority and their position over other people. Let them know just who's in charge, who's the greatest. These brothers were hoping to snag the top spots in the coming administration of Jesus, right? When he took over Rome. They even brought their mom. I mean, I wonder if they're embarrassed after that, right? They brought mom to beg for them. They wanted to achieve the top spots. How could they get there? How could they hang on to the power is what they were wondering. And Jesus turns everything on its head. He says the way to the top is actually just the other direction. It's serving other people. Daryl Bach, in his commentary on the parallel passage in Luke, he says this. In this text, the commitment is not to power, but service. The commitment is not to separate from those who are ruled, but to identify with them. Elitism is not the 12's call, but service and community among equals. The contrast to the world's definition of leadership could not be greater. So greatness in the kingdom of God, in the kingdom of heaven, is measured by our service to other people. And there's really three kind of principles we're going to pull out to be able to improve our serve, if you will. Here's the first thing I should do to improve my serve. Choose to humble myself. Choose to humble myself. Matthew 18, starting in verse 1, here's what Jesus says. At that time, the disciples came to Jesus and asked, "Who then is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?" And what does Jesus do? Goes through all the list of the great leaders of Israel, right? Not them. No, he doesn't do that. What does he do? He called a little child to him and placed the child among them. And he said, "Truly I tell you, unless you change and become like little children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven." We're not talking about who's the greatest. We're talking about getting in, right? You need to change your attitude. Verse 4, "Therefore, whoever takes the lowly position or humbles himself like this child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. And whoever welcomes one such child in my name welcomes me." You see, recognition is what the disciples were longing for, right? That's what they wanted. They wondered what position would be the top. If they could figure it out now, they could aspire to that position and be set down in history as Jesus' top leaders, his top generals. To be second in command to Jesus, how awesome would that be? What will people in my hometown think? I'm sure they thought over and over. And then Jesus has to go and burst their bubble once again. He says, "You guys are entirely wrong. You have no idea how my kingdom works. What you need to do is actually cultivate a heart for the weakest and the smallest and the most helpless, the unnoticed. That is the focus of my kingdom. And what's the example? It's a child. Not a child, not any child, a little child, right? A small little child. You should all become like, aspire to be like this little child." Why a child? Because a child is insignificant. A child appears to be weak. Society had no value on that child. All they were is a burden, right? They can't help you militarily. They can't provide more money for your family, right? Don't bother Jesus with the kids. Just put them, get them away, right? He's got important stuff to do. The disciples were known to do that before, weren't they? Don't bug Jesus, little kids. But Jesus takes the littlest ones and says, "This is who you need to become like." Jesus says, if you don't change the way you think about position and leadership in my kingdom, you won't even step foot in it. The right attitude is one of low position, understanding that God is in first place. We are in second. He's to be honored and to be glorified above all. We, all of us, are simply the supporting cast, right? Remember John the Baptist? I'm not even worthy to untie the sandals of Jesus. That's how he saw himself. So furthermore, they said, and us, we're to aspire toward valuing the weak and seemingly insignificant. Jesus doesn't just stop, but he adds that last verse, doesn't he? He says that welcoming a child in his name is just like hosting Jesus himself. How many disciples wouldn't love to have Jesus come to their house in their community, right? They would have loved that. He says, if you would welcome a child in my name, as if you're welcoming me, I'll be right there in your midst. We have a neighbor who's finishing up a fellowship in child psychology from Singapore. A number of months back, him and his wife came over for supper, and they hung out for a long time. I don't know if it was 2.5, 3 hours, right? We were eating supper, sitting at the table. And Mian is this gentleman's name. He took a genuine interest in our kids. And what was interesting is the kids even sat there the whole time. Now, usually the kids are like, okay, I'm out of here. I'm going to go. I'm out of here. Can I leave? They didn't leave. They sat there. He took a keen interest in them. He peppered them with questions over and over and over. Aria, how's middle school? Samara, how's elementary? How's this? How's that? What do you think of that? How do you feel about that? Went on and on and on. And when he left, our kids were like, wow, those guys are awesome. Aren't they the nicest people ever? How often do we sit down and focus on kids and ask them questions and really want to get to know them, right? It stuck out. It really stuck out. But even our society, we can say we love kids, but how often do we kind of push them off to the side? So you and I both know how our words and our actions can either help and build up children, or it can quickly take them down and destroy them. Sometimes we're so focused on our own thoughts, our own ideas, our own concerns, our own goals, that the kids get in the way, don't they? They're in the way of what we want to do. We hardly take notice of other people. So we need to start taking notice, not just of kids, but of other people. And don't stop there. Start to value them. Ask questions. Invite them in. Listen to answers. Seek to build them up. There's a volunteer at Riverside Elementary for a long time, and he volunteered at a bunch of schools. His name was Mr. Ted, okay? So Mr. Ted was a retired IBMer, older guy, and he was very recognizable because he had a yellow jacket on that he'd bike in, and Bridget saw him at Riverside, and he would bike all over town. He would bike to school all the time. He'd bike over to some place that had a sale on something he'd get. He probably had millions of dollars, but he like biked everywhere to save money. So he would volunteer with these kids, and he volunteered in multiple school classrooms each week. He loved kids. He really loved the newcomers and those who were learning English. And so he volunteered in those classes as well. He'd read with them. He'd help with math and about any other subject they needed help with. And what an inspiration he was to lots and lots of other people. And he did this because he loved Jesus. He believed he should pour himself out into other people. Kids were not to be ignored. They were to be valued. And Mr. Ted treasured them, and he built them up. And he's since passed away, but many a teacher, Bridget nods her head, and kids will still remember Mr. Ted. But if you Googled Mr. Ted, you wouldn't even find him, right? Most of us will never know about Mr. Ted. So one of the greatest volunteers, right, someone who humbled himself, like Jesus told him to do, you'll never read about. You read about lots of other folks, won't you, that have achieved a lot of great things, but you'll never read about Mr. Ted unless you do a really deep dive and dig up some information. But that's the opportunity for us, right? We can visit the shut-in. We can visit people who are overlooked, who are left out. The question is, will we take time out of our lives to humble ourselves and do what Jesus asked us to do? What's the second way we can improve our serve? Number two, I can seek out the lowliest tasks. So it's a bit longer passage, but I want to read it to you because it's really, really important. John 13, verses 1 through 17. It was just before the Passover festival. Jesus knew that the hour had come for him to leave this world and go to the Father. Having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. The evening meal was in progress, and the devil had already prompted Judas, the son of Simon Iscariot, to betray Jesus. Jesus knew that the Father had put all things under his power, and that he had come from God and was returning to God. So what did he do? He got up from the meal, he took off his outer clothing, and wrapped a towel around his waist. After that, he poured water into a basin and began to wash his disciples' feet, drying them with the towel that was wrapped around him. He came to Simon Peter, who said to him, "Lord, are you going to wash my feet?" Jesus replied, "You do not realize what I am doing, but later you will understand." "No," said Peter, "you shall never wash my feet." Jesus answered, "Unless I wash you, you have no part with me." And typical Peter fashion, what does he do? "Well then, Lord, not just my feet, but my hands and my head as well, right? Give me a bath." Jesus answered, "Those who've had a bath need only to wash their feet. Their whole body is clean. And you are clean, though not every one of you." For he knew who was going to betray him. And that was why he said not everyone was clean. When he finished washing their feet, he put on his clothes and returned to his place. "Do you understand what I've done for you?" he asked them. "You call me teacher and Lord, and rightly so, for that is what I am. Now that I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also should wash one another's feet. I've set you an example that you should do as I have done for you. Very truly I tell you, no servant is greater than his master, nor is a messenger greater than the one who sent him. Now that you know these things, you will be blessed if you do them." Can you imagine what someone's feet looked and smelled like after trudging through the roads and byways of the ancient Near East? There should be a picture for you that'll pop up. There you go. This was a job that the host would typically assign to a servant. You can imagine how that dirt and grime would turn into mud and muck as you wet the feet and scrub them clean. And where were you? You were on your knees. You were well below the visitor, the guest. You were in the position of a slave, serving at the whim of someone else. It's not just amazing that Jesus washes his disciples' feet. You know what's more amazing to me? Look at the timing of when he does it. This is their last meal before he suffers a terrible, terrible crucifixion. This is the last time they'll be together. Like the good old days when they traveled and they healed, they slept together, they taught people, they roamed around the country. Jesus saw this act as so vital that he saved it for the perfect, most memorable moment. This supper they had would never, ever be forgotten by them, would it? It's not forgotten by us. So if that's the case, on the night he was to suffer, he showed them, it says, the extent of his love by serving them, by getting down on his knees and doing a job that no one else would aspire to do. He wanted to sear a message in their memories. If he, their Lord and Master, would do this task, maybe they would do more for each other as well. Over the centuries, the church has practiced foot washing, right? It's been a ceremony, it's been an ordinance, it kind of depends on your tradition. And those are all good things. And while washing the feet of someone can be a powerful lesson to do every once in a while, or regularly, I guess, I don't think Jesus' message was limited to just washing feet, right? He was thinking broader, bigger. He was saying, if I, your leader, am willing to get down and do this task, then you should be willing to do the same kinds of things for other people, to be in my kingdom. When I was at Camp Victory, we started a training program called, well, it had different names. It was counselors in training, it was leaders in training, it was servants in training, but it was training, I guess, for high school kids. So I recently looked at an old outline of the program from probably 20 years ago or longer. So I read it and said you had to be 15 years old to participate. And there were really three things that we did. The first one was Bible teaching time with me, which the kids ended up calling Happy Time with Jeff. I'm not sure who was happy, but it was Happy Time with Jeff. Then there was serving in the kitchen, right? That was the next step, is to serve in the kitchen. And the third one was cleaning the bathrooms. Now, every leader, counselor, or servant in training looked forward to other things, canoeing, tubing, even teaching kids about Jesus, right? Having fun games, you know, being able to help in those areas. I didn't come to camp to clean bathrooms. But you know who did clean bathrooms? Who was the best at cleaning bathrooms? It was Jim Barnhart. And he was the director for years and years at camp. And you know what Jim could do really, really well? He could work a plunger like you have never seen in your life. And he taught me the tricks of the trade, and so I had to teach those kids as well. You see, every week after camp was over, we all had to clean up camp, and the first place he would go typically is the bathrooms. And he would clean up the bathrooms, the place that no one else wanted to go. The director cleaned the bathrooms. That was a good lesson. And I tried to pass it on to the kids as well. But instead of running from the work, he embraced it, and he saw it as a way to serve everybody else. How are our plunging skills today, right? How do we look forward to serving and helping where others don't want to? Or do we keep it at the bottom of the list and try to forget about it or pass it on to somebody else? Another picture I want to put up there is a picture of Larry. Now, I had to check and make sure he wasn't here. Now, if he knew I was talking about him, he would absolutely kill me. He really would. He likes no recognition at all. Larry is somewhat retired, you could say, but not really. For over 25 years, he's led home repair mission trips down south. And from the Rochester area, he's taken upwards of 20-some people every time for a couple weeks in the winter. And it's Habitat for Humanity kind of work. But a number of years ago, we connected and he started doing projects that we're doing locally throughout the year. So he's self-employed, and he'd get his work done, then he would squeeze in projects for families in the area whenever he could. And Larry's not just any volunteer. When a task has no takers, guess who will jump in? Larry. I'm not saying he likes to do it, but he will do it. He will dive right into it. When we work on old mobile homes, and there's leaky pipes under the home, not many of us want to go down there. But guess who will go down there? And who's gone down there more than once? It's Larry. When we need to demo out some old walls and ceilings full of lath and plaster and probably 100 years of dust on top of that, who's the first person to start ripping it down? It's Larry. That's what he does. There's no task that he shirks at or he wouldn't do. Over 70 years old, and he can outwork any of us who are working with him, hands down. So the question is, do we shy away from tasks that seem too menial or below our pay grade? Or we jump at the chance to serve other people, to take on tough jobs, to be an example, to serve the lowliest of tasks. That's our opportunity, right? So what's the third way? A third way to improve our serve in the kingdom of heaven. Focus more on others. Focus more on others. One of my favorite passages has to be this one in Philippians chapter 2. Here's what Paul says. Therefore, if you have any encouragement from being united with Christ, if any comfort from his love, if any common sharing in the Spirit, if any tenderness and compassion, then make my joy complete by being like-minded, having the same love, being one in spirit and one of mind. Do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit. Rather, in humility, value others above yourselves, not looking to your own interests, but each of you to the interests of others. In your relationships with one another, have the same mindset as Christ Jesus, who being in very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be used to his own advantage. Rather, he made himself nothing. By taking the very nature of a servant, by being made in human likeness, and being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to death, even death on a cross. Therefore, God exalted him to the highest place and gave him the name that is above every name, that at the name of Jesus every knee should bow in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue acknowledge that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. Paul says, if you've reaped any benefit whatsoever from knowing Jesus, then you can make me a happy, fulfilled man by being unified. How are you unified? You don't think things are just for you. You don't do things just for you any longer. Instead, you value what others need above yourself. And then he says it again. You consider the interests of others, the needs of others. And who's the ultimate example of being others-focused? It's obvious, right? Think of all the conflict we have in our lives with other people. How often is it because we're seeking our own justification, right? We want to be right. We want to be heard. We want our point of view to be accepted. We want to do it our way. The focus, whether we realize it or not, is not seeking the good of someone else. It's not seeking how I can serve other people. Instead, it's so often focused on how I can get what I want. And that leads to conflict and disunity. So the solution, Paul says, is Jesus. Look to his life. Look to how he spent himself. There's no one who is more others-focused, is there? In his very nature, he's God, the text says. He's divine. He is way up here. But it also says he didn't greedily hang on to his position of power and authority, right? He didn't hang on to it and just stay up with his Father. Instead, the text says he made himself insignificant. He came down. He became a servant, a slave, if you will. He put on flesh and bones like all of us, like all of his creation. But he went even lower still. He allowed himself to be humiliated through death. And not just any death, right? It wasn't like a military death or a natural death. It was the death of a criminal. And what does he end up? He ends up naked on a tree, dead in front of the world. That's unbelievable. The Creator allowed that to happen to himself. And why did he do it? He did that because he had the interest of other people, of us, in mind. Remember the Bible verse? For God so loved the world, he gave his only Son. Jesus knew what was needed to rescue us, to save us, and he allowed it all to happen to him. But the story doesn't stop there. The text goes on. It wasn't a tragic event to be mourned over for years to come. Instead, he's risen from the dead. His Father not only raises him from the dead, but he lifts him to a place that is above everywhere else in the universe. And it says someday every knee in heaven, on the earth, and even under the earth, wherever that is, everyone is going to bow their knee to Jesus. And on top of that, every last person will admit that he is the Lord. That is the reversal that Jesus took, right? From his serving us. And in the end, the Father will be honored and glorified. Living our lives for the sake of others, for their interests, is what God calls us to do over and over again. A great illustration of this is John Perkins. I don't know if you've ever heard of John Perkins or not, but I would encourage you to look up, go to Amazon, look up some of his books. They're fantastic. He was born in 1930 in rural Mississippi. His mother died of nutrition deficiency, basically starvation, when he was 7 months old. And his father sent him and his siblings to live with his grandmother, who had 19 other children. He was lost in the mix, and he said he never felt much love. His family was known as bootleggers and gamblers. That was who they were. They were not the church-going type, John would say. He also didn't get past third grade for education when he was a kid. He experienced plenty of injustice as well. He'd haul hay, this is probably about 1940 or a little before, he hauled hay for a white man and expected to be paid the normal $1.50 for his daily work. But instead, how much was he paid? 15 cents. In the 1940s, his brother Clyde returned from serving our country in World War II, but was killed by police officers in a racial incident. His family was scared for him, and they told him to go maybe move to California with a cousin of his, and he did. After moving there, he found lots and lots of opportunity. He worked his way up and became a leader in a steel foundry. He later got married, had a growing family, a great job, a house, and a safe community, but he still didn't know Jesus. At the age of 27, he said he was a workaholic. He was trying to fill the void of his life with money, with position, and he heard the gospel. His entire life was turned upside down. He started to do Bible studies in prisons and met many young men who also lacked love in their lives. John Perkins soon felt the call from God to move back to Mississippi, where he left, and reach out to the troubled youth back in the home communities where he was from. And he also wanted to work toward reconciling whites and blacks together. In 1960, he and his family moved back and spoke in schools and jails, reaching many for Christ. But he saw that a lot of people would come to know Christ, would then move on with their life and move out of their community and go to a bigger city. And there was a big void of leadership. And so he wanted to challenge them to stay there and live there and become the leaders in those communities. So he committed to living there in Mississippi the rest of his life. He's a contemporary of Martin Luther King Jr. He's still alive. He's 91 years old today, and he's a founder of the Christian Community Development Association. He was beaten by white officers on two separate occasions, being imprisoned for peaceful demonstrations, but he held nothing against anybody. He wanted them to know Jesus, and he wanted reconciliation to happen. That was one of his three kind of primary principles to start the Christian Community Development Association. One was reconciliation. He knew the love of Jesus, and he worked for 60 years. He still is, to reconcile people to Jesus and to each other. Jesus didn't hang on to his position, did he? He could have hung on and stayed where he was, but he came to serve us. John didn't hang to his position. Instead, he poured it out to serve other people for their benefit. He moved next door to those who were suffering. He suffered right along with them. He was oppressed right along with them. He's lived and he's encouraged thousands of people to move into some of the toughest, crime-ridden neighborhoods in our country to serve them for Jesus. And you may not move to inner city Minneapolis to do community development, although some of you might, and some of us probably should. But wherever you are, God's given you an opportunity, right, to reach out, to pour yourself out for other people. Jesus isn't saying, grab your best life now and hang on to it. Get rich and successful. It's all for you. Build up a bunch of wealth and retire. He says, pour yourself out. Whatever you do, pour yourself out for other people.